This session is being broadcast as a live Weber Training teleclass, and registrations have come in from approximately 95 or 96 different countries around the globe. I'd like to thank Gojo Industries for sponsoring the broadcast of this teleclass lecture. So this is the last session of the day. There are two sessions here. Again, I would like to thank the live audience for showing up, and I'd like to introduce you to a world of people who are joining you by teleclass audience. And to the teleclass audience, thank you for joining us. There is a live audience of millions in the room in front of me. There are, as I said, two sessions. Oh, at the end, there will be time for questions, I hope, for both sessions. For those of you in the teleclass audience, we're doing something that we have never done before, and that is we're allowing you to ask questions by email. And you can do that by just emailing question@webertraining.com. That will come directly to my computer on the platform, and I will ask the questions of the people to whom they are directed. The first session today is Martin Kiernan's session. Now, Martin is no stranger to most of you. If you have listened to teleclass education even for a little bit, you will recognize his voice. If you were here yesterday, you will recognize him as delivering a fantastic session. Martin is a nurse consultant at Southport and Ormskirk NHS Trust. He's a past president of the Infection Prevention Society. He's very involved in infection prevention and control around the world. In fact, I've known him to deliver lectures in, I think, 8 or 9 different countries, Australia, Canada, Geneva, all over. I can't think of all the places. He's in very big demand. He's very popular. He runs the British teleclass series. So he's in charge of all the speakers from the UK. Martin came to Canada 3 years ago when this conference was in Vancouver. And at that point, the conference was very wet and very windy and very cold. So when we invited him back, I said, make sure you bring your sunscreen and your short pants because Halifax is going to be spectacular. And somewhere above those rain clouds, I'm sure it's a very nice day. So would you please help me welcome the one and only Mr. Martin Kiernan. Martin.
Thank you, Paul. I wish my mother had been in the room to hear that. Right. If any of you follow me on Twitter, I am at EMRSA15. There is the conference hashtag there. As I do with some of my talks, I've already preloaded Twitter with links to all the papers that I'm going to be speaking about, the abstracts and in some cases the full papers. So if you're following that, then you'll get the tweets as I'm speaking. They should appear around that time. I'll stick up my disclosures as well, just in the interest of transparency. I have spoken at meetings organised by various organisations, but the views that you will get from me are my own because nobody else will be stupid enough to think like me. I'd like to also, I'm having a great time this time because when I went to Vancouver, I got norovirus on the plane. So it didn't really matter that it rained because I never went outside anyway. And then it rained. So I seem to be viewing the Canadian National Cloud collection in Vancouver, which isn't quite so bad this time. But I've already had a couple of interesting experiences. Gary got me to taste root beer, which I managed one mouthful of because it tasted like a mixture of Coca-Cola and paint stripper. Not that I regularly drink paint stripper, but... And the other mistake I made was at the airport, they said, would you like to upgrade the car? It's not very much to upgrade to a Dodge Challenger. So when in England, we drive tiny little cars. I thought, yeah, why not? So my wife wandered over, because my wife's come with me. She came to the car with me and took one look at it and said, when do we pick up the drugs we're going to be selling from this thing? Because it's a really big black thing, big red stripe. And I have to say, for the first 500 metres, I thought it was fantastic. And it turned out to be a spectacular failure of biblical proportion, so it's going back today. I'm going to swap it for something that I can actually drive and not steer in a... How does anybody drive that in a straight line? Anyway, I did mention my wife's with me, and so I need you to notice something, because I'm passionate about cleaning, okay? I have a very good hotel services organisation where I work. My own staff in my hospital, we don't contract out our cleaning. They're our own cleaners. I'm really... encouraging them to do the best they can. They do a great job for us, and I'm absolutely passionate about standards of cleanliness and tidiness and order when I'm at work. Okay? Just on the off chance that any of you bump into my wife while she's here, I now need you to look at this screen. And now you have no recollection of me saying any of that, so I'm quite safe. Okay, so linking cleanliness and infection. Now, there's been an awful lot of talks around cleanliness and infection at this meeting, and you're going to see some of the authors that other people have quoted in my section. There's plenty of debate over the years, and I've been in this game 23 years now, and I've gone from the era when, well, it didn't really matter so much about cleanliness. Certainly in the UK, the cleaning budgets were often seen as a soft target for management. There was a feeling in the world we can treat the people with an infection anyway, so we don't have to worry too much about the state of the place. And cleaning has never, up until relatively recently, been considered to be an evidence-based science or evidence-based profession at all. It's just the bottom, almost the bottom rung of the ladder in the way the hospital runs, and I really don't think it should be anything like that. To me, it should be right up there near the top. But if you go back just over 10 years, Marcus Dettenkopfer did a systematic review in the American Journal of Infection Control, and he found there wasn't any convincing evidence that disinfection reduces rates of infection. Fast forward that 9 years, and Curtis Donsky's done a similar sort of systematic review, or a review in Thoragic last year, saying that actually high-quality studies are now supporting environmental decontamination. And people like Stephanie Dancer, I don't know if you've ever heard her or heard her speak or read her work, she's always felt that if what's happening is good, founded on good common sense and the theory is behind something is sound, then the evidence will eventually emerge. And I think that's absolutely the case when it comes to linking cleanliness and infection. What we do know is pathogens survive very nicely in the environment. Thank you very much. I mean, MRSA, 300 days possibly. TB, a couple of weeks. HIV, not that long. C. diff, a long time. Hepatitis viruses, maybe a few hours. I always put gonorrhea up on that because in England, ladies don't sit on toilet seats in case they catch gonorrhea from a toilet seat. So I like to put that up there just to show people, because all this hovering goes on in the ladies, I've heard. So if you get in the closet and count to 15, you can park your backside wherever you fancy. It doesn't really matter that much. It doesn't survive particularly well. Now, I'm a good collector of good headlines, and we've had quite a fuss in England. We had a big problem with MRSA bloodstream infections, or MRSA in particular. The media really love MRSA in England because they can spell it, so it's nice and easy for them. Have you ever noticed serious infections are always initials? Now, if you tell someone you've got severe acute respiratory syndrome, then they go, oh, that. But if you say you've got SARS, oh, that's a lot more worrying. So things like TB, they're always initials, much more worrying. TB is always, to me, a bit like Neil Diamond. It's something horrible that happened a long time ago, but it keeps coming back, unfortunately. So anyway, here's one of our headlines from the UK, The Mop of Death. This was a tabloid newspaper called The Sun. They sent a man they called the UK's leading microbiologist into University College Hospital London, and he came out saying he grew MRSA from everywhere. When the Department of Health sent a couple of microbiologists along to look at this gentleman's laboratory, they wrote a report about his laboratory and described it as a small wooden structure, approximately 6 foot by 4 foot, situated in the rear garden of his house. In other words, it was his shed. It turned out this chap, who was the Sun's, the UK's leading MRSA expert, had bought his degree from the United States, and he'd grown skin staphylococci, not MRSA. But skin organisms of no pathogenicity don't make a great headline, whereas the mop of death certainly does, and we've had some really good ones over the years. My favourite one, which I haven't got a slide of, is something like "Killer Rapist Has MRSA in Pervert's Jail." Yeah, so that gets the Headline Writers Guild Lifetime Achievement Award for the most emotive word you can get into one sentence. So we had a big fuss about MRSA because the media were jumping up and down about it, and the press were getting involved, and we had things like this: hospitals banning flowers to get rid of MRSA. Now, okay, hospitals are a bit of a pain because patients don't get much room to put their stuff in a hospital in the UK, a couple of square feet on top of the locker, and if you stick a load of flowers there, the poor cleaning staff have to struggle around it. But are they a risk of infection, really? Are they dangerous? Well, okay, if you go back to the 70s, you find a couple of papers published in The Lancet which talk about Pseudomonas being found in flower vases, and people are a bit worried about that now. But how does it get from the flower vase to the patient? Now, nobody clears their suction catheter by just dipping it in the flower vase. And actually, the following year, a chap called Howard Hughes did a little bit more work on this, and he sampled the flower vases at the same time of the patients, and he found that the patients had the Pseudomonas before the flower vases. So he published a famous paper in The Lancet called Protecting Chrysanthemums from Hospital Infection. which is a lot more, probably a lot more sensible, really. Now, I was involved a number of years ago now, probably 15 or more years ago, in a communicable disease task force in the northwest of England. In this days before things got published, but we were asked to look at the role of the environment. And Marcus Tettenkofer, we didn't find great robust evidence saying, you know, dirty environment causes infection. But what we did manage to distill it down to was there were four postulates, if you like a version of Koch's postulates, in that you can definitely show contamination in the environment. You know, if you go looking, you can find, even though, as we heard this morning, quite difficult to find C. diff, or get it to grow anyway. We can show organisms can live in the environment. We can show a significant route to the patient, either on staff hands or the patient themselves interacting with their environment. And none of that would matter if you couldn't clean. But you can. So you can reduce the number of organisms in the environment by various techniques, if that's basic cleaning or going through the modern non-touch cleaning systems that we have. Now, the problem is, of course, as soon as you clean something, you recontaminate it again. So you have this transience of cleaning, which we don't really fully understand, in that you clean something, you reduce the bioburden down to a lower level. Then, unfortunately, see, we send people home, and we clean their room, and we use hydrogen peroxide in my organisation, so the room is pretty clean. But we do have to put someone back in the blooming room, which means it gets recontaminated again, and before long, you're back up to where you were. The only way to reduce this plateau is to increase the frequency of cleaning, but that costs money. And the most expensive cleaning agent we seem to have, we call it elbow grease. Yeah, getting people to get in there and give them the access to be able to do it as well. And that's the problem. The transience of cleaning, it's only for a short period of time, and the more frequently you clean, maybe the less contamination there is. We don't actually know, though, what the optimum level is, the safe level. Is there a safe level? I've been doing this 23 years now, and there's spectacular amounts about my own subject I don't know, which is really handy because it keeps you going, doesn't it? Now, if you look at the evidence around the patient environment, there's a number of studies that are quite useful, and the significant things is that a lot of these things that can be contaminated are high-touch items. So, you know, OIS study from years ago looked at doorknobs, bed rails, which people like other people have shown that these are the most frequently touched surfaces within areas, instrument dials. You know, people's hands touch all of these and then they go on to somebody else. You know, MRSA on the door handles of 20% of the rooms with somebody with MRSA on it, but also on nearly 10% of the door handles of rooms without somebody with MRSA on it. And yet people will go in and out and they don't think they're touching anything significant by touching a door handle. And I've done this with ATP and my organisation when we were doing some pandemic flu training. I had a group of staff in there, and I was telling them all about the contamination and really it's high-touch areas that are the problem. And I got an ATP swab, and I swabbed the door handle and showed it was dirtier than any commode, or, you know, organic matter-wise, than any commode that I'd sampled in the hospital that week. You should have seen everybody trying to get out the door after the session. There's all their feet coming up, and they're trying to get through the door. But, of course, they'll touch the next door handle. That sort of disappears fairly quickly. I used to get people arguing, well, you know, I went into that side room, but I never touched the patient. The surgeons were really good at this one because they're quite simple characters in the NHS. And you know, they've gone in and they've done all sorts of things in the room, but they haven't touched the patient, so that's fine. Because if only the patient, you know, they attract every organism to them and nothing else is contaminated. Well, as John Boyce showed a long time ago now, in 1997, that 42% of nurses who went into a room and just touched the environment around a patient picked up MRSA on their hands. Now, this is good evidence when you're trying to argue for the moments of hand hygiene, isn't it? Because you can say, here's the evidence to support this, even though they don't necessarily want to do it. Fascinates me how medical staff can be an expert in my subject. You know, when I'm talking about blood culture contamination, they seem to have a really good argument about it. I would never go and stand next to them in the operating theatre and say, you sure you're using the right approach here? Maybe we'll think about doing something else. That's not going to work, is it? So why is reducing contamination of the environment important? Well, a lot of these papers were discussed this morning in the C. diff session. You know, you get contamination in the environment, both from symptomatic patients, but also from asymptomatic patients. You get people you don't know are carrying C. diff because they're asymptomatic and we don't test them. We don't look for them. And if you went down the screening route, where do you go with that? You know, as was discussed this morning, it's very difficult. You know, and as Rig showed, even with rooms with people without C. diff colonisation or infection. Still nearly 10% of those environments were contaminated with organisms. So it's really important that we try and reduce the bioburden as much as we reasonably can. Now, that's not only protecting the patient from areas around them, but also about protecting the patients from themselves. Now, this is a paper from Gary French and John Otter, published in the Journal of Hospital Infection a few years ago. It was ostensibly around showing that actually routine cleaning isn't that effective and that you should maybe think about a secondary method of cleaning, and it was around hydrogen peroxide. But for me, what I got out of this paper, what I use this one for, is showing that the extent of environmental contamination around patients who we know are MRSA positive, and that nearly three quarters of the sites around them within their bed area were likely to be contaminated with MRSA. So I use this for moment two of the four or five moments for hand hygiene, which is protect the patient from themselves. You've gone in, you maybe touched an area, you're going to do an aseptic technique, you're protecting the person from themselves. And that's how I can use this sort of study to show that the environment is significant. What about transmission of multidrug-resistant gram-negatives? Nazir did a review of this a few years ago in Clinical Microbiology and Inspection and Infection, and they did a prospective study in intensive care units, and they found successive people going into a particular room in an intensive care unit was at risk from the organisms the previous people had had. Things like Pseudomonas and Acinetobacter. Is that the environment, is it clinical equipment in that area that's actually the problem? You know, because we have a division of labour in many organisations. I don't know if you have the same sort of thing, in that the nurses do maybe certain pieces of equipment and the cleaning services or hotel services staff or whatever you call them, the environmental assistants, will do other pieces of equipment. Is everybody always absolutely sure about who cleans what? They did some quality audits in this piece of work and showed that over half the rooms were not cleaned correctly, including the high-touch items, you know, the doorknobs, the monitor screens and the bedside tables. So which increases the risk to the next occupant. I think if I was being admitted to a hospital, I'd be looking at the kit thinking, has all this been cleaned? Right. Would I put my mother in this room? Would I put my mother-in-law in this room is an entirely different question. Because there's a slightly different level of proof on that one. Okay. Problem with that study was there was some missing information. You know, what they said they were quality audits, but it doesn't say what they were, really, what they looked at, what the methodology was. And it would have been really nice to know that, because they will have known that. Well, they would have known that. And that's the problem with word counts in some papers. You just can't fit absolutely everything in. But there's nothing wrong with emailing the author of a paper and to find out, well, actually, what did you do? Because that could be useful to me. You know? They didn't actually look at the actual results of the cleaning audits to find that the substandard ones, if that's where the transmissions occurred, to see if there's any link. Maybe they didn't have those data to see if poor cleaning was likely to be the result of the transmission. And they didn't talk about these divisions in cleaning duties. You know, the cleanliness of the clinical equipment, which is often a nursing role. I don't know what it is in Canada, but certainly in the UK, the clinical equipment is the nurse's job. But what do you call clinical equipment? We have silly divisions of labour in England where the hotel services staff will clean the bed frame up until a certain point on the bed frame, and then it's nurses from then up, which is a bit... I really don't like that. You know, if you a toilet's a toilet, but if you put a toilet raise on it because somebody's had a joint replacement, that's classed as clinical equipment. So then that's the nurse's job to do that. And I'm going to come back to that later on, because divisions of responsibilities isn't great. So have we got any really good evidence that cleaning is a good control mechanism for MRSA? Or MRSA, I think you would call it. Well, Stephanie Dancer did some work on this. This is in the public domain. If you click on the link that's now on Twitter or go searching for it, it's in BMC Medicine. Well, they put an extra cleaner on two wards, only Monday to Friday, because as we all know, all the microorganisms take the weekend off as well. They don't multiply, and they just lie there and do nothing and wait for Monday morning before they can get going again. So they put an extra cleaner onto two wards, and they did an extra just detergent-based cleaning for about 6 months. But what they did was they swapped over halfway through. So it was a prospective crossover design, and they monitored 10 hand-touch sites in these areas when they were screening them both weekly. The patients were monitored for MRSA infection because they had some historical data as to how many MRSAs they would like to pick up in that area. And then when they did grow MRSA, they did further genetic work and DNA fingerprinting to see if they could actually determine whether there was any transmission. And what they got here, and I haven't got a pointer, so I'll just describe it, but when you got the swap over between the extra cleaner, you'll notice in the red boxes at the top, when the cleaner went... From ward A to ward B, suddenly we got a cluster of cases on ward A. And the similar sort of thing happened at the end. In the washout period, two small clusters of infection appeared at the end. The upshot was that the extra cleaner they felt was just one extra person Monday to Friday, and doing two cleans a day was responsible for a third reduction in colony counts on hand touch sites. And they got a 27% reduction in new MRSA infections, despite the fact that actually over this period of time, the wards got a lot busier and they actually had more MRSA patient days. There were more MRSA positive people around in the unit. They expected, based on historical data, 13 infections during the enhanced cleaning period, but actually they only got four. So they had a good reduction in infection. And when they did the further molecular work, they actually demonstrated identical strains from the environment and for patients, some of which were actually months apart. So they were getting the same organism many months later. So there's something that's just sat around there for a while that they couldn't determine what it was. Was it cost effective? They added it up. If you double the money on this, you'll get it in Canadian dollars. So the cleaner was getting about $25,000 a year. Consumables just over $2,000 a year. We guesstimate the price of an MRSA surgical site infection at about $18,000. So by coming down between 5 to 9 cases, then just one ward saved somewhere between $61,000 or $60,000 and $140,000. So there's significant savings to be made. That's just one ward in one organisation by putting a cleaner in for 4 to 5 days out of 7. So I think, this has got to be cost effective. You know, if your organisation is trying to maintain its reputation, that's got to be a good thing as well. The problem is, we're not always sure, really, who's responsible for cleaning for our environment of care. So this is a paper from Dumigan and Boyce from 2010, where they found that there was a confusion in the division of labour about whose job it was to clean what. And I find this in my own organisation. Somebody else thinks it's somebody else's job. I actually hate the expression infection control is everybody's responsibility, because when something becomes everybody's responsibility, it sometimes becomes nobody's responsibility. Because you assume somebody else is going to do something, okay? It's quite interesting. We've just been doing antimicrobial audits in my organisation, and we set a target of 80% compliance with stop review dates, because we have paper. We can't force people down through an electronic route. So, you know, it was always 80%, and we couldn't achieve it. And as soon as we put it up to 90%, we always hit it, because when it's 80%, everybody else thought someone else will get it right, and that will make the audits right. But as soon as we put the standard up, everybody started to behave, because then they knew that they would be spotted if they weren't going to be spotted. What they found in this paper was that the systems to actually monitor cleaning effectiveness were actually not very good. So they put in ATP and they reported improvement. Unfortunately, this study, they just looked at the housekeeping items only, because I'm often very interested. And, you know, generally, housekeeping staff aren't so bad, but I do find that nurses aren't actually brilliant at what they do. From cleaning point of view. Now, there's been a couple of nice papers that just come out from Dick Zoutman recently, looking at cleaning services across Canada. And there was two papers, one from the talking to cleaning managers or environmental managers, and others talking to infection control professionals. And this one here, the infection control professionals, about two-thirds reported that they felt that the cleaning staff were getting adequate training. But still a third didn't think they were getting adequate training. They felt there was really good cooperation, but they felt there was opportunities for further linkage. So being consulted about surface finishings, they weren't always being consulted about disinfection products, although they felt that what the products being used were okay. But they weren't always consulted over changes to cleaning or disinfection procedures either. The media headline, of course, and we picked up this in the UK, is that a third didn't think their hospital was clean enough for infection control purposes. And in fact, one in five felt that it was either rarely or never clean enough for infection control purposes. And that's the sort of thing that the media will love, of course. So are resources actually adequate? This is the subject of Dick Zeltman's second paper. He did an online survey of environmental services staff. He got a response rate of about 50%, which is pretty good. But you find that these people are normally pretty engaged in what they're doing. They felt that actually their supplies and equipment budgets were adequate. They felt their training was adequate. They actually felt their training was more adequate than the nursing staff felt that their training was adequate. But they also, I thought this was interesting, they didn't train, a quarter of them were not trained to deal with spillages, and 10% didn't do any updates on cleaning methods. So if you have been trained a while ago, cleaning is actually a very technical job, and practices change and new techniques come in and your new equipment comes in, and maybe they weren't being updated as well as they might do. But the causes for this were about half said they didn't have enough staff to do the cleaning properly, and the auditing was variable, both in frequency and how they went about their auditing. And how we go about our auditing is also quite interesting. Now, time isn't always the only thing that matters when it comes to cleaning. And I like short papers. This is a nice short paper from Mark Rupp. published in Infection Control and Hospital Epidemiology last year, where he showed actually that people in a room for a very short period of time could actually clean very effectively, whereas if you look in the bottom right, somebody who's cleaned for over an hour in the same sort of room has only hit 20% of the sites. They use the ultraviolet markers. The ultraviolet markers are quite interesting. They're just about coming to the UK. I've seen them over this side of the Atlantic for some time. And you just go around, you dab some sites, and then you count them up and see how effective cleaning is. And I think they're a really good training aid, but I'm not sure about their usefulness as a way of targeting poor cleaning. I've heard from Stephanie Dancer recently that she'd been in one organisation where they'd gone to use the ultraviolet markers, and they were actually saying to the cleaning staff, your standard isn't good enough. And what happened was the cleaning staff had actually gone out and bought their own ultraviolet torches. So when they were going to clean a room, they turned the light off, shine the torch around the room, find the 10 little dots and make sure they got those. So then they got 100% compliance. People are very good at finding a way around a system so it suits them. So, and to me, actually, if we're using that sort of technology to punish people for not doing a good enough job, to me, the failure is I don't think we've sold them the message why it's important to do it. And I also feel that the organisation should be telling people, not you've got to get in there and clean that job and I want to see 10 out of 10. What they should be saying to the people is you've got a really important role in patient safety. You are a very valuable employee to this organisation because you are keeping our patients safe. The cleaning staff should be amongst the most valued. They are the worst paid often, and they should be the most valued in an organisation because everything comes down often to lowest common denominators, and this is a really key thing for me. In my organisation, if we have an outbreak of norovirus, the chief exec, when it's over, will go and find all the cleaning staff who are involved in that outbreak and thank them personally, and it gives them a real lift because they know they're valued, and that takes him 10 minutes of his time, and it is repaid in buckets in the motivation of the staff. It's very important. So how do we assess cleanliness then? A few studies, but you know, recently there's been some good ones comparing the different methods using ATP, ultraviolet, and visual, you know, comparing with cultures as the gold standard. Fluorescent markers and ATP come out better than subjective visual inspection, but you'll know this in your own life. If you don't sometimes see things, and people certainly working in their own areas don't see what's in front of them. If you go to a hotel and it all looks fine, and then suddenly you find something you didn't like about it, suddenly everything else about it becomes crystal clear, and you find every little hair that's on the bed sheets and that look at that in the plug, and it's disgusting, because you suddenly start to see everything. But until that point, everything looks fine. And so visual inspections are no good. You know, these contaminated surfaces can be classed as clean very easily unless we use some scientific methods. Now, some people, like Anderson and Young, have done audits of clinical equipment, and they found that they've obviously they're not going to get good clinic attention. Here's the ATP score, if they were cleaned by professional cleaning staff, was 64% lower than if they were cleaned by the nursing staff. They actually found that nurses didn't do it very well at all. They looked at 27 items and found 89% of them failed the benchmark. So if you're admitted to a hospital and the nurses are cleaning your clinical equipment, how confident are you that it's safe to use on you? I like to use the word safe. Okay, when I tell people we're auditing them, it's not we're auditing them. It's to make sure that what we're using on them is safe for the next person, and it sort of changes the mind a little bit, I think. So, terminal cleaning. Phil Carling's done the major work on this, and it's going back a few years now. But they looked at high-touch areas in isolation rooms, and they found half of them weren't cleaned. So, we have an isolation room where you know somebody had an infection, still half of them not cleaned, and the range 35% to 81% of surfaces not clean. Big variation in cleaning items. Not done. Toilet handles, bedpan cleaners, light switches, door handles. All the high-touch areas, 30% of them cleaned. So this is risky for us, and we have to convince people that these are the important things that we're going to be cleaning. Now, in England, we've had a bit of a fuss over the summer a couple of years ago when it goes very quiet and the media go looking for stories. So here we had a story about nurses were cleaning wards at cash-strapped hospitals. Now, if you look on Twitter, you'll find there's a hashtag line that a comedian called Al Murray News, which is called Not News, and that was not news. Any of us worked in the health service, we all knew that nurses clean. We do it. You know, if a bed needs to be done now and there's somebody coming up from the accident department and you can't get hold of the cleaning staff, a nurse is going to clean that bed to make it ready for the next person. It just has to be done. So, and we do it. So there was, you know, and that's not great because they don't do it very well. Michelle Alphas did this really great work where she put the markers on toilets and commodes generally are cleaned by a nurse, should be cleaned straight after every patient's use, okay? And she found that the commodes were there and not cleaned three-quarters of the time. In fact, not cleaned at all in three-quarters of the day sampled. So if there's, you know, forget about hovering on public toilets because you're worried about getting gonorrhea. People should be hovering over a commode because they don't really want to touch that. But the problem is our patients are rather infirm and they're not going to be able to hover. And we shouldn't be telling them that anyway. And is it any surprise she found C. diff in a third of toilets and two-thirds of commode samples? Right. Do nurses clean then? Well, Sarah Culkin in Nursing Times did a survey of over 1,000 nurses and just about generally about cleaning. They found 50% thought their cleaning in their organisation was inadequate. A third said a bed wouldn't be closed if it hadn't been cleaned properly because we have targets for admissions. And about three-quarters felt that they hadn't had adequate training to clean. Don't forget, we're requiring these people to clean. And actually, in the preceding 12 months, she asked them, what percentage of them had undertaken some sort of cleaning? 80% of them had done a room of a non-infected patient. 40% of them had done a room of an infected patient. So these are people who are not trained to clean, having to clean an isolation facility ready for the next patient. Would you be confident about it being done properly? I don't think so. Look, they're doing toilets, they're doing bathrooms. To me, if you're going to acknowledge that people are going to be doing this cleaning, you have to train them. Now, these are the bane of my life. This is a mattress, of course. See, it's got the word condemned on it. In many organisations, the word condemned is a bit like being in death row in some of the states in the United States. It can take months or years. You know, appeals go to the Supreme Court, and it gets its last meal about five times, and there's always a plea for clemency from the ward manager because she doesn't want to buy another mattress. Well, I hate these things in that nobody looks inside them, because when you do and look inside them, sometimes you find stuff like that. Now, somebody has a liquid stool on it and there's a hole in it, it all soaks in, it dries out. The next person to sit on it gets an aerosol back out because the hole's still there. Yeah? I've been in organisations that had horrendous problems with C. diff. And when I said, what's your mattresses like? They said, oh yeah, we did an audit 6 months ago and 68% of them failed. I said, what have you done about it? And they say, we're preparing a business case. No, you're not. You're going to, we'll go and do another audit because the company did it. And because 6 months has gone on, they go and look at them again. Over 70% failed. Change all the mattresses. C. diff rate drops like a stone. Because it's like a powder puff of spores, isn't it? Not great. Now, and we need to get involved in design of stuff to make sure. I wondered if some company could make a cover that would change colour if it got moist on the inside so you'd see straight away instead of getting someone to unzip it and have a look inside. It's great when you can get involved in design, actually, because the Department of Health in England, about 4 years ago, got involved with the Design Council, and there were some focus groups, and they decided they were going to build some kit that was actually fit for purpose. And this was the commode that we developed with them. And the top lifts off it. Oh, it doesn't show up so well there. The top lifts off it. It's really easy to clean. The bottoms all slide in together. The tops can stack. It's very easy to clean. And here, the bedpan macerated pulp, you put it down into the bedpan as opposed to sliding it underneath, because that way it takes out the splatter factor. Yeah, you know, somebody's got rip-roaring diarrhea and the bedpan's underneath, a certain amount of it bounces. Well, not with this, because it all gets contained within it. It's just something simple to get around it. But why not ask the users? That's what I say to manufacturers. They're forever bringing me stuff to solve a problem I don't have. Why not talk to us and we'll tell you what the problem is, and then we can work together and get something a bit better. As I mentioned, I hate divisions of responsibility. I don't often quote Florence Nightingale, but this is a good one. The root of evils which have to be dealt with is the division of responsibility and reluctance to assume it. It's knowing whose job it is to do what. And I'm afraid the weakest link, as you've guessed from me talking about cleaning so far, the weakest link is, of course, René Zellweger, who's had no training in cleaning whatsoever. But it's nurses. We don't train them to clean. Okay. And you look at the cleanliness of equipment disinfected by nursing staff. This is Nancy Havel's work. Again, they used ATP aerobic cultures. They found the equipment wasn't cleaned as per protocol, disinfected, and saying, okay, we must have education and feedback. They were talking about regular updates, but what's a regular update? You know, how often do we do this? And they didn't actually study it going on beyond that, which is a shame. Wipes, well, I'm sure many of you have heard Dr. Satter's or Professor Satter's allusions about wipes. I won't push this, but you know, we all use wipes. They're very convenient, But label claims, they tell you they'll kill absolutely everything, and some of them do, and some of them are better than others, but nothing kills everything. You know, we don't. If we're buying them, we must know how they work, what's the technique to use them, you know, what's the absorption, etc. And there's no great evidence about the use of these against biofilms, which we know exist in the environment. And if you use them badly, you can actually create more of a problem. There's a few studies that show repeatedly using a wipe, if you're not changing it regularly, means you then just move organisms around. You just shuffle them around a little bit. They aren't killed. They're just taken from surface to surface. And you could clean, if you don't clean in the right order, you could transfer spores from a low-risk surface to a relatively high-risk one nearer the patient. Biofilms in the environment are fascinating subjects, and I'd recommend anybody who's interested in this to listen to Karen Vickery on this, but she's published a couple of good papers where they grew viable MRSA from biofilm despite terminal cleaning in an intensive care, and she felt that current cleaning practices weren't going to be adequate because you couldn't actually penetrate the biofilm very easily because the organisms are being protected within the biofilm from the agents, and then they can persist in the hospital environment. I did a little web-based survey because I gave a talk like this a couple of years ago at the IPS conference, and I like Twitter because you can just stick a survey up and a group of nurses will look at it. It's not scientific. I'm not saying it was. I was just trying to get a bit of basic information. It was about the time of the Nursing Times survey, but their results weren't out at that time. And I asked nurses how often they expected and required to clean pieces of equipment, or are they expected to do it, and virtually all said that commodes, the environment, mattresses, clinical equipment, and human waste disposal equipment. I then asked them about where they got their training from, and the majority of them, well, were getting it either from their colleague or basic training, or having no training in how to clean these bits of equipment at all. You know, something like 25% were actually trained by their employer to clean a commode. The rest, someone else taught them how to do it. Well, if they learnt badly, you're going to learn badly. The others, you find your own way. Same sort of thing with the environment, same sort of thing with mattresses. Again, very low levels of training from employers. They were a little bit better about training people how to clean clinical equipment, probably because it's thousands of pounds worth of stuff and they don't want people to break it, whereas it's difficult to break a commode, maybe. And human waste disposal equipment, again, not much training going on. And yet, human waste, feces, is the most contaminated substance anyone's ever going to come into contact with. It contains every pathogen you can think of. Norovirus, C. diff, all the multidrug-resistant gram-negatives, MRSA, VRE. They're all in human feces, and yet people are very blasé with the stuff. You know, I suppose because we all produce it. We take it with us wherever we go. Everyone has their own. Well, unless you're doing fecal transplants, in which case you maybe get somebody else's as well. And it's transmitted, it's actually passed through the body through a really clairvoyant organ, isn't it? Because your rectum predicts your immediate future. Just as well it does. Because you get a few seconds notice about what's about to happen to you, which is just as well, because otherwise we'd be walking around with bicycle clips on or something like that. So in this web-based survey, the interesting thing was that actually, despite the fact they weren't being trained, the nurses were actually very confident they could clean. And over 80% said, yes, I'm confident I can clean well. Have you ever been assessed, was the next question. No. So actually, they don't know. We can do a lot with education. We can do a lot with the UV markers, actually showing them that's why it's important to do this. And should you clean? Because a lot of people would say, should nurses clean? The title of the talk, Too Posh to Wash, came out of the media because it was felt that when nurses in England went to degree-level training, they wouldn't be interested in doing washing or basic duties again. Well, should you clean? Actually, the majority said, yeah, we should clean. So there was no doubt that people felt they should be doing it. How do you therefore then get people to learn? How do you get people to actually take this on board? Well, there's three methods. If you tell someone, they're probably going to forget it fairly quickly. If you show them, they might remember. But if you get them into involved in it, then you stand a bit more of a chance of getting them to understand it. And I quite like this. It was never actually published, but there's a link here for the Outpatient Surgery Net, Patak and Tostenson. It's a very simple idea. Okay, they just decided that, okay, here's the unit we want to clean, so we're going to assign cleaning duties to different people. Okay, and the first thing they did was avoided using general categories, because if you class it as equipment, it becomes nurses, and if you class it as furnishing, it becomes hotel services. And then you get this division straight away, and one person's equipment is somebody else's furnishing. So they took that out straight away. They then created a simple manual of photographs of pieces of equipment. They went around and photographed everything in the unit that they were going to have to clean, or someone was going to have to clean, okay? And they got together a group of people, and they constructed a list of who's going to do that, how often it was going to be done, and how to do it. very simple, very effective, but the most important thing was it was all the staff on the unit who drafted and agreed it. So there was none of this, that's not my job to clean that, that's your job to clean that. So everybody is involved, they all know what they're supposed to do, they all know how they're supposed to do it, and they know how often they have to do it. And it's very simple. Plenty of opportunities for research, I think, when it comes to cleaning. Okay. If we go out daily disinfecting, if we use disinfectant wipes everywhere on high-touch surfaces, does it actually add a significant benefit to just cleaning it all when the patient goes home at the end? Does it help? Does it reduce the risk to that person from his own environment? We don't know. How often do we actually supposed to, you know, how often should we disinfect a surface as opposed to clean it? We don't know that either. What about doing all the rooms in high-risk wards or the whole facilities if you're going to do a facility-wide intervention? There are some hospitals in England that have an empty ward, and they will close a ward, move it to that ward, while that ward is cleaned, disinfected, snagged if there's any problems, and then they will gradually decant the whole hospital over a course of a year. But unfortunately, these days, not all of us have that sort of facility where we can do that. Other questions? Are we supposed to get down to absolutely no organisms around? Well, that's never going to happen, because as soon as you put patients back in an area, you get recontamination. So can we get similar results with low levels of risk of infection to a safe level? Is there a lower level at where you could say, well, actually, we will accept that sort of level? We don't know that. It's really fascinating, you know, that if somebody brings in the latest piece of high-tech equipment into your organisation, where ultraviolet light or hydrogen peroxide, we're going to say, where's the evidence for this? We need reams of evidence. Anything in peer-reviewed studies, how does it work? And yet, actually, if we change a convenience item, such as a wipe, we don't really ask for very much at all, even though the total spend for the organisation may be exactly the same. We don't always ask for the same level of evidence. So there's a few bits of thought there. Final questions, honestly. Should we actually say, okay, here's other strategies like reducing environmental contamination at source? So the studies that now show that whole body washing with chlorhexidine reduces risk of central line infection to patients, does that actually reduce the amount of environmental contamination? Should we actually have a bundle type approach where if we reduce the risk of the patient contaminating the environment, then the environment becomes less contaminated, et cetera, et cetera? Should we identify people who are more likely to shed pathogens into the environment, and then do we focus on the lightly contaminated sites from those patients? A few final points. Senior nurses, I found, and managers will actually resist training nurses to clean. They all say it's not their job, but they do it. Now, in England, we have bed pressures. A spillage happens. Somebody's got to clean it up. You don't walk off and leave it or ring a phone and let somebody else turn up half an hour later. So we have to accept that people do it. We have to accept what is the obvious. Nurses do clean. We have to accept they don't do it well, and we have to accept this increased risk to patients. So we have to convince our nursing colleagues that this is actually critical and train them to do the task. I'd like to conclude by saying thank you very much to Chica Canada Itcan Canada for inviting me, and for Paul for having me over. I've had a fantastic time, and I've got some memories and some sights in my mind that I will take back and treasure forever. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you very much, Martin. That was very entertaining and very interesting. We do have some time for questions. For those of you in the room, please come to one of the microphones in the room. For those of you who are on the teleclass, again, you can send your question by email to question@webertraining.com. Is there anybody in the room that would have a question for Martin?
Fellow tweeter.
Great presentation, and I love the tweets during the presentation. That is an awesome idea. So fluorescent marking, and I have a couple of posters on fluorescent marking, gaming the system, and you mentioned that. We actually observed that. Despite gaming the system, the results were not affected by a large margin. Mm. So even with the fluorescent, them gaming the system, they still did not change the results drastically. But as a solution, what we did, we had a control, unknown spots that changed, because then they believe that the spots will be the same all the time. So we gamed the gamers. Thank you.
That's called chess, I think, isn't it? I like that idea. To me, though, if people are gaming, it's because you haven't sold the message well enough in the first place, because they have to know that their job is hugely important and does, in fact, affect patient safety.
Nikki from British Columbia, just a comment. I find it interesting, the survey you did with nurses, that managers and older nurses don't think that they should clean, and yet the perception out there that, yes, we should.
Yeah.
Now, I've been nursing for a long time, and I'm thinking back to my training, and I don't recall being taught particularly how to clean. The expectation was that, you know, when somebody used a bedpan, you rinsed it off, sprayed yourself, and, you know, gave it back. And so it's an interesting comment, because I think we have to go back to the beginning then. And if we really think that nurses are going to clean and it's that important, then we need to be teaching them in their schools that they need to come out there with that responsibility. Because I've worked with nursing schools too. I've never seen one that teaches somebody how to clean a commode. And I don't know, nurses in here, have you been taught how to clean a commode?
No.
And the majority of us are nurses. So
I know. Interesting. Yeah. I totally agree. But if you were a patient,
and
the nurse was the only person who'd used that commode between you and the last person, who else would do it?
Well, that's the way I teach. I always say,
me too.
If you're willing to sit on there then you can give it to a patient.
Yeah.
If not, clean it.
Absolutely. That's the easiest thing, isn't it? If you're not happy, would you sit on that now?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Are there other questions or comments?
Hi, I'm Lisa from British Columbia. Accent doesn't really portray that, but I honestly am, and I still hover. Just saying, I have great quads. Just to go back to your comment on selling it to people, I use the glow germ stuff for logistics in emergency health. We have a team of logistics guys who clean the ambulances on a sort of 42-day cycle and every day. So we have a deep clean and a daily clean. And they actually come and ask me to come and measure their cleaning. And they use it as a teaching tool. They'll come in and say, come and have a look, and am I doing the right thing?
So. See, that says to me the message has been sold and they know it's important, so then they want assurance that they're doing it themselves.
Absolutely.
And that is fantastic, isn't it? They've really been sold that message well. So well done.
I'm Anne Head from Cape Breton, an LPN, 38 years, and I worked at a nursing hospital and was trained there, and we had to do all the cleaning from the commodes, the bedpans, the room, with Wescadine.
Yeah, when I trained, you were a student nurse and you spent the weekend in the sluice doing the cleaning. That's what you did in England. You don't do that now. You can't get the students to do much cleaning. To be honest, I'd be happy if they cleaned themselves.
Great. On that comment and that admission, Martin, well, thank you very much. I'd like to thank Gojo Industries for sponsoring the broadcast of this teleclass lecture.